One track. Listen.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Anthony Joseph Landman. Welcome to Season 11, Episode 4 of One Track, the podcast where I invite today's leading composers and performers of new classical music to answer a little simple question that I ask them. And today with me on the show is composer Matthew Maslanka. He's here to talk about some of his father's music, of David Maslanka. And Matthew, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time. This is going to be really interesting.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And oh yeah. I was going to mention this before we started recording, but I forgot. I just finished interviewing earlier today, Eric Konectis.
Oh, cool.
So he said to say hi. And he said to tell you that he still has your trombone mute.
Eric and I went to school together at Michigan State. And I think I spent a summer as his roommate. And wonderful man, fantastic composer. Maybe the best ears I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great ears. Yeah.
You got those harmonic series or the tonal systems of all sorts. That man understands deep.
It's crazy. Yeah. We talked about that in some depth in the interview. But yeah, afterwards he was I told him I was, you know, interviewing you next, and he told me about the trombone mute, and I was like, "Do you want me to tell him that?" Or he was like, "Yeah, you can tell him." So there you go. You know, you have a trombone.
It's only been 15 years.
Right. So I'm just going to ask you the question from the start and we can get into it. And the question is, if someone, and I'll modify it a little bit because of the subject matter, but if someone was interested in getting to know your dad's music and you only had one track on you, what track would that be?
Well, this was a tough question.
Yeah.
Dad's music spans 40 years and three distinct stylistic periods. And where I ended up was a piece from 2010 called O Earth, O Stars. It's a double concerto for flute and cello and wind ensemble. The thing for me here is that this piece touches every aspect of his mature style. Okay. That it, you know, and we'll talk about it more in depth when we get to the music, but there's the chorale aspect of his music, the furious, you know, almost vicious element to it, and then the true heartfelt spiritual center of it. And this piece is a very special one.
And you know, I would say, you know, this is never an easy question to answer, you know, the question, the main question of the podcast, but I'd say you were put in a particularly difficult situation, you know, one, because you already mentioned, because you had so much music to look at, 40 years. And I know your dad was prolific, you know, had a lot of music. And you're put in a position of sort of choosing for someone else.
Sure.
You know, so I'm curious to know sort of from your perspective, and I know you already mentioned, you know, you chose this piece because of the musical aspects that are represented in your dad's composition. But, you know, just from your perspective in choosing this piece, was this a choice that you think you would have made, like if you're walking around with a piece in your pocket, or perhaps one of the pieces that your dad may have chosen if he was asked this question?
Well, we actually answered this question already. There's an article on the website where I asked him to make an introduction for himself. You know, what would you do? You know, what do you want people to know if they're just getting to know you? And we picked three pieces, Child's Garden of Dreams, Symphony Number 4, and something else, which I've forgotten. And they were, again, to display the different time periods where he came to full maturity. So A Child's Garden of Dreams is 1982. It is by far his most famous work. Well, Symphony 4 comes pretty close. But that was the piece that put him on the map. And it is a kind of summation of his early life and his early understanding. Symphony 4 is around the time when he became, you know, after the move to Montana in 1990. So I live in New York City in Midtown, and there's a lot happening back here. I live next to a police precinct and a hospital.
Oh, wow.
And two high schools. So we got sirens, I'll tell you that.
Wow. Okay.
Symphony 4 happened around the time that he moved to Montana with a family in 1990. And that's the first piece, the first major piece he wrote after that in 1993. Okay. And it is his most popular work to play outside of maybe Give Us This Day. And there's a difficulty in encapsulating the music by performing snippets of it, by going to excerpts. I understand that it's important to give people an easy way in, to have a thin wedge.
All right.
Like, here's the little thing that's going to capture your attention, so you're going to go find the thing it's pointing to. But one of his central convictions about music was that the whole musical piece needs to be performed and heard.
Sure.
And without that, you don't get the context. You don't understand. You know, he grudgingly allowed certain pieces to be played in parts. Something like Symphony Number 2, the finale, is a really popular thing for high school bands to play. It's exciting and it's cool and it's fun. And unless you have the first two movements, it feels incomplete. It feels like we're starting in the middle of something. And, right. Oh, now we're doing this. But when you have those first two movements to set the stage, to give you the... we got construction equipment today too.
I was like, what is that?
this is an exciting day. Well, maybe I'll wait for that to pass. You're going to chop all this up, I'm sure.
It's just the sounds of New York.
Yeah, we have.
That's all. Yeah.
Without the first two movements of Symphony Number 2, the third one, which is celebratory and exciting, stands on its own, but doesn't have the meat, doesn't have the weight behind it to make it truly cathartic, to make it truly the heart of the piece. So with that in mind, I tried with the excerpts that I chose to have complete thoughts within them that made sense of themselves. And, you know, I can talk through the context, but if you're at all interested in this music, please go listen to the whole piece.
Absolutely.
It's the thing that it makes sense only in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We're only going to hear excerpts on this show, but I always preach this, you know, it's to give you a taste. So hopefully you'll go and listen to the whole thing. You know, yeah. That's the goal.
Links in the description.
Right. Yes, exactly. So for this first part of O Earth, O Stars that we're going to hear, this is from the first movement. And by the way, do the movements, I'm sorry, I did not look this up. Do the movements have titles of their own?
Yeah. The first movement is simply called Chorale.
Okay.
Jesu meine Freude. And this is the a setting of the Lutheran hymn, but with his own harmonization.
Okay. And anything else you want to say about this first excerpt before we play it?
This is a concerto for flute, cello, and wind ensemble. And it is the where we jump in here is the first time that they enter. So we've had an introduction from the rest of the ensemble, and the, oh man, they're going to be doing this for a while, aren't they?
You've just got a little, you know, early music concrete going behind you. It's fine.
Is that the way that is? Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Okay. This is their first entrance, and this is when we get the first really full statement of the piece.
Okay. All right. Let's check this out. Our first excerpt from O Earth, O Stars. Okay, that was our first excerpt from O Earth, O Stars. And the performers here are, you know, a college ensemble. I think they did a fantastic job with this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is Illinois State University's recording with Steve Steele as the director. Dad had a very long relationship with Steve, and Steele ended up being the primary commissioner of Dad's works, especially for wind ensemble, between, let's say, 2000 and 2010. And it's a body of work which is deeply important. So this collaboration is also with I've forgotten the performance.
I have that information right here. Yeah. But it's Kimberly Reisinger, flute, who I know. She's played my music. Great.
Is fantastic.
Yeah, and then Adriana La Rosa Ransom on cello. Yeah.
And they are just gorgeous players. Dad has had a long relationship with Kim Archer, or Kim Reisinger. And she was this piece happened right around the time that Steele was married, and Kim actually played the flute at their wedding. And this is a whole a network of friendship and respect. And this is just gorgeous, gorgeous music. This music is... How about let's start with this. Every morning, Dad would start his composing day by playing a Bach chorale, by getting himself into the headspace to write. This piece or this movement does the same thing for this whole piece. It is the getting you in the headspace to receive the music. So we have the chorale statement here, and then it grows, and it grows into this powerful statement from the whole ensemble with parallel chords. And it's a testament to how the simplest melody can be transformed. It has this deep power in it. It can go from very, very quiet to very, very loud. And the stability, the groundedness of it becomes even more amplified. This is Dad was fascinated with the power that comes from deep time. That you have these old melodies, Bach, they were old when they got to Bach. And they are simple. They're stepwise. They have small skips in them. But they speak to the core of what feels natural internally.
Yeah.
There's a concept by Nicholas Nassim Taleb in his book called Anti-Fragile, where he talks about things that get better the more they get banged around. The more where things like folk songs have this quality, where the more they're sung, the more they take on the character that they truly have.
Huh.
And I think this is one of those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love to hear, and I have to say, I don't hear it that often, but I love to hear a piece like this, where when you talked about the first movement is that moment where he just took time to get everybody and himself probably in the right headspace for what's coming. And, to be able to do something like that and, really successfully means you have to be a composer that is completely confident in their craft. Like you have to be at that point in your career to like pull something like that off successfully.
This is the point in his life. So this is 2010. This is, 35 years into writing, that he's gotten to the simplicity on the other side of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a golden path that you can, that he's threaded and found the points of stability internally that need to be there and focuses all his attention there. So there's nothing extra. There's nothing extraneous. It's just the rightness that needs to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, I wanted to ask you this because, I was thinking back to when I first started studying composition in like the late 90s, even in the late 90s, there was still this like stigma around band and wind ensemble, like that it somehow wasn't as serious as like orchestral music or something. And I think your dad is definitely one of these people that helped just kind of destroy that idea. did he feel like he was part of that, or that was that a conscious thing on his part, or he just did his thing and that was just a byproduct?
I like to think of reality in terms of chaos and feedback loops, that you have the underlying ground of being and the little swirls that come up and then build other swirls. And then there's a virtuous cycle that spins up as a result. So in this case, Dad had a friend who played piano, and he wrote a couple of pieces for him. It turned out that he was on the Eastman faculty and got a piano concerto commissioned for the Eastman Wind Ensemble. And, you know, then people heard that and went, holy crap, that's really amazing. And, you know, started commissioning more pieces for wind ensemble from him. And so this was a natural cycle.
Hmm. You know,
people heard him and asked him to write, and he wrote, and then more people heard him and asked him to write, and so he wrote. There's a real hunger in the wind band world for good music.
Yeah.
Mostly because, as you say, it's been that extra ensemble that you teach kids with, or you have marching bands, or is for military, you know, services or whatever. But real music happens with orchestras. Everybody right. knows this.
Right.
But there's a whole history that leads up to bands being the working class ensemble. You know, you have the Italian banda in the Middle Ages, and the whole, there are courtly musicians, there are street musicians, there are music that comes from hunting, and bands come from the tradition of, you know, being in the street, of doing marching, of doing church parades, of having, so the people who were making music for royalty had their set of instrumentation. And the people who were making music for people for entertainment had their instrumentation. And as it comes up now, these ideas become entrenched. And so you have a orchestral and chamber music tradition, which has all of the veneer of money, of aristocracy, of right. patronage. That you can make gorgeous, amazing music there. And there's no question. And we now have the opportunity, because of work like from people like Gustav Holst and Percy Grainger and H. Owen Reed, Dad's teacher, where there's the discovery of, oh, wait, there's some really cool sounds that are possible with this instrumentation. And it's a more accessible way for people to get into music. And because there's such a hunger in the wind band world for that, it's this rich ground for experimentation, for discovery, for real change to be made. Now, most orchestral audiences are excited to hear the same Brahms and Beethoven symphonies
right.
over and over and over again. And there's a resistance to new sounds there. Maybe that's changing, but the world is crazy at the moment and nobody knows.
I think it's largely still the truth. Yeah.
So Dad was certainly aware that there was an opportunity to make, to have basically unlimited freedom. That, you know, the ensembles may not be of the caliber of the New York Philharmonic, but they're going to work their asses off to get it done.
Yeah.
And he far preferred the quality that you get from people who deeply care about music and want to make it. And so it all worked together.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. I'm just, you talked about how your dad got into, composing for a band. He said it was sort of an organic thing. Mm-hmm. What was his relationship with band before that? Like before he wrote this piece for the pianist?
He really didn't have much connection with it.
He played in
high school.
Oh, he did. He did play in band. Okay.
But he was a clarinetist. He played in the Greater Boston Youth Symphony.
Huh.
And all of his education was in the traditional classical mold. He studied at the Mozarteum in Austria in Salzburg, but when he got to Michigan State University and studied with H. Owen Reed, there was the first real understanding that band was a viable place to make good music. part of the other problem with talking about band is that there are about 15 different terms for the ensemble.
Right.
There's wind ensemble. There's wind band. There's band. There's symphonic band. There's symphonic wind ensemble. There's and they're all talking about slightly different things. There's something like there's an idea of standard instrumentation for a wind band, but it's not nearly as settled and, you know, defined as an orchestra.
Right, right. I'm still trying to figure out the grading system.
The grading system is a huge trash fire.
Yeah.
publishers put numbers on things. You have the state music educators ensemble organizations that put numbers on things. And, you know, a New York six is very different than a Texas six. And pieces are more or less arbitrarily put places. There are guidelines in place, but choosing music is about loving a piece, having a sense of what your ensemble is, and then figuring out how you can bridge whatever gaps are involved.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And now getting back to O Earth, O Stars.
Yes.
So we heard this first movement. We're now going to jump to the fourth movement. And what are we going to hear during this excerpt?
This is a movement called Dragons and Devils of the Heart.
Mm.
It comes from a Carl Jung quote, which is, it is wise to nourish the soul, otherwise you breed dragons and devils in your heart. And also from A.A. Milne of Winnie the Pooh fame. Sometimes when the fights begin, I think I'll let the dragons win. But then again, perhaps I won't, because they're dragons and I don't.
Nice.
This is violent music and trying to wrestle with those dragons. So,
okay.
Let's get into it.
All right. Here is our second excerpt, the fourth movement from O Earth, O Stars. And that was the second excerpt from O Earth, O Stars. That's an amazing moment there. and his and you know, we could talk about a lot of things all day, like, you know, his you know, his orchestration and all that stuff is just so masterful and really amazing. And I was curious, you know, sometimes I ask people this because I'm kind of fascinated by it. With you sort of growing up in this environment, you know, I came from a totally non-musical family. Like, no one in my family is, you know, not involved in the arts even, like, in any way. So when there's someone like you that grew up in this environment, it always kind of fascinates me. But what has been your kind of relationship with your dad's music, you know, throughout growing up and getting older?
It's a lot.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Before I get into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the music while it's a little bit fresh in my head.
Sure, sure.
This track, especially this bit, talks about one of the most important qualities of dad's music, which is the persistence through the hard thing and being responsive to the honest core truth of the piece. So we have this, and it builds up, has this enormous climactic resolution feeling moment, but then it doesn't stop. It keeps going into it's still working out the central problem of the piece. Like, that climax is a point of breakthrough, but it's the breakthrough that gets you to the next level.
Right.
I struggle with where to stop this excerpt because the resolution of that moment takes a long time and it needs to have the space to build up. So a lot of composers build things up beautifully. They take their time, they build it up gradually, and then they get to their big moment, and then they hit the big moment and then stop and don't let anything happen about it. Or worse yet, they stop right before the big moment where they build it up and then they just straight up don't pay it off. And it's incredibly frustrating to hear. And this is the thing that I think dad does better than nearly anybody else, which is get to the big moment, have it be honestly itself, take the amount of time it needs to take to be fully present, and then take the amount of time it takes to let it be in that space and to deal with the repercussions that you've built up. There's a true honesty and courage and bravery that's required to do that.
Yeah.
It's so easy to shrink away from the powerful moment. It's so easy to let it just fizzle out and, you know, go do something else because it's hard to look at. And if I can, you know, have one thing that comes out of this interview, is for composers to be honest with themselves and be honest with their music. Like, this is the whole point of what you do. Get to the hard part, look at it, and be present in it and allow it to be itself rather than choking it out.
Yeah.
That said, growing up with dad was natural. It felt right. You know, this is everything that I've ever known. Of course we listened to Beethoven. Of course I'd help him make photocopies of his scores. Of course I'd, you know, copy tapes from him to send it to directors. So it was just part of the fabric of living. And it took quite a long, maybe even till college, before I realized that I had a very different childhood than most people did. college for me was a lot of discovering that what pop culture was. You know, seeing all the movies that I never saw when I was a kid, or, you know, listening to all the music. Like, I discovered Daft Punk and you know, all the electronic stuff.
Right.
In actually early when, slightly earlier when I went to Interlaken summer camp, like, I started hearing some of this stuff for the first time. And I went, oh, yeah, all right, I'm into it. But there are certain things that I get out of, you know, EDM that are also present in Dad's music, which is this relentless rhythm, this pulse that is insistent and the heartbeat of the piece. And again, a lot of composers are scared of rhythm.
That's so true. Yeah.
It's okay to have straight eighth notes for a minute.
Yeah.
And to live in that place. One of the ways that, you know, both of these worlds talk to each other is in creating environments that are otherworldly, that you can live in, that these are sound environments where there's, it transports you into another realm. One of Dad's early discoveries was of shamanic drumming. And the power that a simple, like, eighth note beat at 120 on a tom-tom does to you after a half an hour sitting there. That's all that's happening. And you can go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into your mind. And it's the simplest thing in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's right there for you.
Yeah.
And it's one of the draws of dance music is that it's just this beat with some dressing on top, and that beat allows you to be transported.
Yeah.
And when you combine that beat with overpowering volume and a dark club and whatever drugs you're on, like, this is the transformative sort of tribal space.
Right.
So there are different qualities of internal life that are possible through musical understanding.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. I think there is something primal that's activated in us when we hear a steady rhythm.
Yeah.
And yeah, I never understood why so many composers in the classical world shy away from that.
You know? It feels too simple.
It feels
like you're cheating almost. Well, freaking cheat, man. It's okay.
Yeah, right.
Do the thing that feels right.
Exactly.
And if, you know, going full Elliot Carter is what feels right to you, then go nuts. Have fun. And if you're able to transform that into something that touches a person in their heart, more power to you.
Yeah.
Dad's, you know, discovery here of the underlying truth of, you know, the simplicity, you know, being powerful and able to touch people is what attracted him. And if you live in your head too much, then your heart doesn't get to be engaged as well. But if you live in your heart too much, then it's hard to build more complex structures.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the obvious conclusion is here, you know, put them together. One of the big failures of, you know, of dance music is that it just doesn't go anywhere. There's no structure to it beyond, you know, verse, chorus, barely.
Right, right.
And if you can have, you know, long form structures that really hit you, then that drop hits so much harder when you get there.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Rather than, oh, I guess we're doing this again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it, you know, we actually have had this conversation on this podcast a lot about how it just comes down to writing honest music, right? Like, what is truly honest for you? You know, that's a big question I think every composer should seriously look in the mirror and ask themselves, is what I'm doing really honest? Am I being honest with myself about what I'm doing? You know, that's a hard question to ask and come to terms with.
Enormous amount of layers to it as well.
Yeah.
Because you can be honest about the level that you understand about yourself or that you're not deceiving yourself about. And your honesty will change as you develop.
Sure.
Because you'll be able to see deeper into yourself.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think we can hear that in this music of your dad's. This is just like stark honesty, you know, is what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I didn't know your dad, but I have a feeling that that's what he was like, you know, just, you know, his personality.
He was quiet and deliberate as a person. But every word that came out of his mouth was considered.
Yeah.
One of the qualities that he had that was extraordinary is his capacity to create space for other people, to be quiet and to allow them to be who they are. The quality of mindful presence was, you know, deeply evident in everything that he did and how he was, from his most serious to his most goofy.
Yeah.
like he's right there and this is what's happening.
Let's get into this last excerpt that we're going to hear from movement 5 of O Earth, O Stars. And what are we going to hear during this excerpt?
This is the heart of the piece. This is why it exists. This is the movement called O Earth, O Stars, and it is a transcription of that song from his Mass. His Mass was written in 1995, 96, and is his central statement of purpose. Like, this is everything he understood about music to that point.
Okay.
And everything he understood about the world to that point. It's a combination of the Latin ordinary, the normal Catholic Mass, and a poem called Hymn to Sophia, Holy Wisdom by Richard Beale, a longtime friend and collaborator. And it is the ultimate message of the piece is the joining of the male and female divine in oneself, coming to know the love and the presence that exists at the core of reality. So this piece, or this poem, is the heart of Hymn to Sophia, Holy Wisdom. And it reads, O earth, O stars, who watch our pain and our joy, lift us up so that we may see our mother once again. Together, we live the only life there is. Music flows from our union. When the universe expands and contracts, it is the love we have for each other. It is one breath. Mother of womanly embrace, wrap us in the womb of your unending love. So music flows from our union here is the center of the concerto and the center of life. That union of sacred, of mundane, of male and female, of the core of reality. And this is the song he wrote about that.
Okay, let's check it out. Our final excerpt from O Earth, O Stars. Thank you. Okay, that was our final excerpt. Yeah, I mean, beautiful. Beautiful music.
Last phrase. It is one breath. That's when music flows from our union is this enormous statement. All done in homophony. It is evoking sacred music in the Western tradition in the most direct way possible. And then it all drops out into that simple phrase. It is one breath. And it is, that breath is the music, is everything flows from there. The breath in Buddhist tradition, which he followed for the last 15, 20 years of his life, is the center of meditative practice. The first exercise, and maybe the most powerful exercise, is as I breathe in, I know I am breathing in. As I breathe out, I know I am breathing out. And that is the fundamental base on which you go deeper inside and you see the nature of reality and of yourself and your relationship to it. Plus, it sounds nice. I mean, if you're into that.
That's right. Very nice. And on that note, if someone, now we talked about this at the beginning of the podcast, but I want to reiterate here that all of you listeners out there should really go listen to this piece from beginning to end now that you've had some brief tastes of it. And if someone wanted to do that, is there somewhere they could go to hear this thing in its entirety?
All of Dad's music is available on the website. This is davidmaslanka.com, davidmaslanka.com. We have multiple performances of most works, and there are a handful of things that we don't yet have, but A Worth of Stars is up there. And you can see the score and read the program notes. Just get into it. There's so much there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming and sharing this with us. And I know we talked about this before the podcast, but I'm just going to put it out there for the listeners. You know, maybe you can feel some pressure. I would love to have you come back at some point in the future so we can talk about your music, because you're a composer as well. And you're welcome back anytime you feel ready. I can't wait to get into something of yours.
I am excited to see where I go from here. Everything that I've written to this point is basically processing my relationship with Dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the culmination of finishing Symphony 10. And, you know, that feels very much like this is the final exam for if I paid attention to, you know, my life. And I'm feeling more free to figure out what I've got to say for myself. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, me too. Me too. I can't wait for that. And thank you again so much for taking the time. And yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. And if you guys out there would like to send us an email for any reason, you can send one to tony@onetrackpodcast.com. You can support the podcast by going to patreon.com/onetrack. We're on all the usual internets places, and we will see you all next week for a brand new One Track. Later.
Listen.